from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, according to psychologist Kirk Schneider, corporate swindlers, stubborn ideologues, and school gunmen all have one thing in common. He calls it the polarized mind, when someone believes his or her point of view is right to the exclusion of all others. And he says we see this with bigots, bullies, even addicts, and that its symptoms are hidden until something terrible happens. Dr. Schneider joins us to talk about his new book, The Polarized Mind, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Bay Area-based existential and humanistic psychologist, PhD and author, Kirk Schneider joins us for this Forum hour. He's past editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology and vice president of the Existential Humanistic Institute, as well as adjunct professor at Saybrook University and Teachers College Columbia. He's also the author of numerous books, including Awakening to Awe, Personal Stories of Profound Transformation, and Rediscovery of Awe, Splendor, Mystery, and the Fluid Center of Life. And recently he published The Polarized Mind, Why It's Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. And we welcome Kirk Schneider back to the Forum program. Good to see you again and good to have you again.
It's very good to see you, Michael. Thank you.
Well, let's sort of define what we're talking about here with respect to polarized minds. Absolutists or absolutist thinking, I mean, to the exclusion of any other views and maybe even the demonization of other views. That's kind of the nub of it, isn't it?
Yeah. The polarized mind, as I define it, is the fixation on one point of view to the utter exclusion of competing points of view. And to me, this is one of humanity's greatest mistakes, if you could accept that.
Or
throughout history.
Misthinkings, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, because you do go back to the millennia, right up to the present, and
that's
say
right.
That, in fact, the opening first chapter says, except for some radiant departures, human history is strewn with the casualties of one-sidedness.
That's right. That's right. It's a very wide-ranging thesis. And in my study, the polarized mind impacts a wide range of problems, of extremisms in our culture.
Well, in all cultures.
In all cultures,
I mean, the idea that there's no nuance, no subtlety, no ambiguity, and really intolerance and dogmatism is something that has plagued us for, well, since we began recording civilization.
Yes, and I tried to give a particularly depth psychological slant in this book, because there has been quite a bit written from the standpoint of genetic dispositions associating with extremism and polarization. And there's certainly been a lot talked about, religious extremism and ideological extremism. But it seems to me that few people are really getting to the roots of this problem. And that's what I tried to attack in this book. What are the roots here?
Not only the
existential roots.
You also talk about ways of ameliorating the problem, which I want to get in with.
Well, that's right. That's
you.
The second half of the book.
But the range of the book, I mean, in terms of religion and science and government and political movements, I mean, the sweep of the book is very ambitious.
True.
But it's also something that you can locate both in the microcosmic and the macrocosmic sense. I mean, bigotry of everyday life and bullying and vengefulness and arrogance and also mass murders. I mean, you call attention to Newtown, Massachusetts, and you call attention to Columbine and Aurora, Colorado.
These are all ways that people fixate on one point of view to the utter exclusion of competing points of view. And maybe I can concretize it a bit. If I make one theoretical observation, and that is, in my view, many, if not most of our troubles as human beings, I'm talking about psychological troubles, are traceable to one overall problem, and that is our suspension in the groundlessness of existence. Now, I know that's a very heavy phrase right there, but if you think about it, what happens after a great loss? What happens after an illness? What is somebody's experience after they've been abandoned or emotionally abused or ridiculed, humiliated? It seems to me that the experience, and this is something I see every day in my practice and other depth therapists see in their practices, is that the bottom has dropped out. People talk about feeling like a black hole or feeling like they're drowning.
And they often need to fill it up. But exactly. Filling it up with the extreme is not what all people do by any stretch. It's just what some people
do. That's right. And that has to do with one's disposition, temperament, that is, as well as means to filling that hole. Some people collapse before that groundlessness, right? And that's usually what we characterize as being in a depressed position or a highly anxious position, a constricted position, where somebody's just overwhelmed by that state because they have no means of escaping it. They're just totally immersed in it. However, there are a number of people who can, for a variety of reasons, totally avoid that sense of fragility and smallness before existence. And those can be very dangerous people and dangerous minds, the seat of tyranny.
Well, you're talking about, I mean, the ideology of this, that is not ideology, but etiology, for you goes to what you call cosmic insignificance, which, again, is a heavy phrase to grapple
yes.
with. I'm reminded of John Barth, who talked about cosmopsis as a disease and all that of the mind. But it becomes a disease of the mind for you. It becomes a way that people deal with, well, individual trauma, collective trauma.
Well, let's try to bring it down to earth a little more. This observation is upheld by not only qualitative depth psychological research, but a growing number of studies in the area of terror management theory in psychology, which has looked at how death anxiety is associated with so many extremes in our culture and other cultures. Extremist ideology, extremist religious political stands, nationalism, ethnocentrism, racism, extremist drives toward wealth and materialism, and even the highly risk-taking behavior like drug addiction. So death anxiety is associated with a profound sense of helplessness. There seems to be more and more research indicating that what we mean by the fear of death is not necessarily just physical death, but it's a sense of total disorientation and helplessness as creatures. It's a kind of a total sense of being lost, and that's terrifying.
But you know, when you get into that as sort of the ground lay, or the laying the ground,
the groundlessness.
I mean, you think about some of the again, maybe go to the extreme here. Some of the mass murderers and how they just Richard Ramirez, for example, just recently
yes.
died. Or you think about someone like Ted Bundy.
Yes.
There's such an excessive desire for Jeffrey Dahmer for sadistic pleasure and. The horrors are so extreme that they almost can't be explained in human or psychological terms. They almost have to be seen in the ferocity of the appetite, let's say, of some kind of jungle animal, were it not for the fact that those jungle animals often do things to eat as opposed to just doing things for the pleasure of it.
I'm going to go a little out on the limb here and propose that the proportion of extremism the degree of extremism seems proportionate to the degree to which one is attempting to avoid this sense of groundlessness and smallness and fragility before existence. And that means that many, if not most of these people who have committed these heinous crimes, and certainly I had to address this when I looked at Nazi Germany, because it's another highly inexplicable phenomenon in many ways. But what seems to happen is that these people are brutalized or experienced being brutalized.
Almost gets them off the hook a little bit by saying that, you know? I mean, in some ways, it ameliorates the sense of their culpability for sometimes just being, excuse me, inherently vicious or inherently driven by their aggressive impulses or by their desire to simply, well, completely decimate, let's say, as was the case in the Nazis, not only the Jewish people, but the Gypsies, the Roma people, that is, and in many instances, anybody they saw as politically... Or what happened in Rwanda. Any of these kind of things seem to be driven sometimes just by almost an innate desire to destroy and vanquish.
Yeah, I agree to an extent. I think that people have a variety of dispositions toward being aggressive and mean-spirited, even from birth. However, I think we really underestimate the power of that sense of helplessness. I don't think we home in on that enough, generally, both in the popular culture and even in professional psychology, of how triggering that can be for people and how volatile it is.
What makes one a sociopath and another who goes through similar experiences and traumatization, let's say a do-gooder or a saintly person?
Well, again, temperament and the means. One of the problems with people who end up sociopathic extremist is that there has never been a concerted, or rarely been a concerted intervention that has helped them come to some terms with that sense of fragility. And this is certainly true in the case of the powerful leaders that I studied that are sort of case examples of this kind of reaction against the sense of smallness and vulnerability. And that is in the case of the life of Hitler, of Mao, and of Stalin. It seemed like just pure and consistent brutalization from very early ages, often by their fathers, and we see this through history as well and with other leaders, or it's the perception of that, and never really meeting a mentor or what we might call, following Alice Miller, a helpful witness who can make such a difference in such a person's life. And we see this, this kind of juncture between people who have had the consistent brutalization or perception of that from early childhood and never a helpful witness, and those who have met helpful witnesses. And Alice Miller actually wrote a book about this, I think called The Untouched Key, where she compared people like Hitler and Stalin with Picasso and Nietzsche. And one of the major differences is Picasso's and Nietzsche's had helpful witnesses in their lives who helped them to, in some way, become more present to their fragility or be able to work with it, to integrate it.
But you're also talking about temperament, and I'm wondering if, you know, Hitler and Stalin or Mao may just have very different temperaments. I mean, Hitler wanted to be an artist and couldn't make it. Picasso wanted to be an artist and had the talent. But, you know, you mentioned, for example, Adorno and Milgram and others who have talked about and analyzed authoritarian personalities. Temperament and authoritarian personalities would seem to go together in some ways, and yet you're speaking here of early trauma and cause and effect.
Yeah, I think that I believe that we have an imbalanced bias toward the biological and the temperamental, even though I do believe there's a lot to that, and I'm not one of these people who just thinks that everything is environmental and
nurtured
as, exactly versus nature, but it seems to me that we don't have pure bad seed, so to speak, like that Hollywood movie, if you've seen that, The Bad Seed.
Patty McGuire, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a gradient there. There's a wide spectrum. But, you know, some of the greatest, most productive, creative people have come from extremely volatile and calamitous backgrounds and have been extremely disturbed
and even
as children.
Traumatic backgrounds.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kay Jamison's book, Touched by Fire, I think shows that you could call some hundred of Western history's who's who in the arts and literature as clinically pathological at some level.
So if we want to do something about this plague, and you do describe it as a plague.
Yes.
We would have to do something about eliminating existential panic and providing, obviously, better childhood, better mentors, all of those kinds of things. That goes without saying. But also, you touch on the importance of humility and the importance, I mean, this may be a cognitive element or dimension to making people understand their relationship to the ground of being in a more humble way.
Well, humility is huge. My basic antidote, or one antidote to the polarized mind, is what I call the awe-based mind, AWE, which is basically...
Which is not all these young people saying, it's awesome.
No. It's, I mean, it's great that people are talking about awe more and more, but it can be trivialized. Now, the sense of awe at its root is really a kind of commingling of dread, veneration, and wonder.
And mystery.
It's quite a combination. You know? Absolutely. That's all part of it. But I sort of condense that to the sense of humility and wonder or adventure toward living. And it seems to me that the great depth psychological traditions and interventions and people who come out of that mindset promote this sense of humility and wonder toward living, a sense of adventure toward living. In other words, these people are in touch with both our great fragility before life and limits, as well as our incredible participation in something much greater than ourselves.
Let me remind you that Kirk Schneider is our guest this hour, and his book is his most recent book, which we're talking about, is called The Polarized Mind, Why It's Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. I'm thinking about all the people who are listening who have infants or toddlers at home or planning to have children. Talk about, I mean, how do you raise children to be awe-inspired or to look toward awe or, for that matter, humility?
Well, this is obviously a huge question and a pivotal question. I devote some time to it in the book. My initial feeling about this is that it's very important if the parent can communicate to the child that no matter how hurt or fragile or pained that child is, he or she has also been selected from the mysteries to live. And that is an amazing, incredible opportunity. The communication of that, it doesn't even have to be through words necessarily. It's a sense of prizing and of recognizing how we've all been chosen, selected, to have this opportunity, and that immediately ties us
all in.
You mean
just existence?
Just being alive, just being. And that immediately ties us all in to the vastness of the universe.
I was thinking about something I read recently about Samuel Beckett walking on a boulevard in Paris, and someone said, look, it's a beautiful day. Doesn't this make you feel lucky to be alive? And Beckett's response was, I wouldn't go that far, which is a great kind of singular example of Beckett's thinking in many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, there are many, for example, who don't necessarily relish not only living, but their lives. I mean, this is why we have a plague of suicides, too, and right. self-destruction.
But I think a lot of that is after that core sense of being born, you know, and of recognizing that core connection between us and all of creation. That is when the degrading and the conditioning and the devaluing, unfortunately, happened so quickly. I empathize with a lot of writers who talk about how this existence seems absurd. Or there's a kind of a nihilistic feeling about it all. What does it all amount to? To me, I acknowledge that, and it's still incredible. And nobody has been able to debate that point to my satisfaction. It's still amazing. It's so radically puzzling, and that alone is exhilarating, at least for me and for others who are turned on to that.
Getting back to that awesome question about how you raise children.
Yes. Okay.
For the moment, I mean, I think you really bring in the importance of something that used to be laughed at by Gary Trudeau when John Vasconcellos, the former assemblyman, made a great deal of it, and that's self-esteem. I mean,
yes.
Care for oneself and belief in oneself and feeling of confidence and feeling that life is worth living to essentially expand the self.
Absolutely. Self-esteem is critical. And how do we get self-esteem? But through the sense that we are accepted at a very core level. And that's what I was pointing to before, the sense of acceptance before existence itself. And somehow the communication of that, the delight in the parents' eyes and ways of relating to the child conveying that. And through allowing the child to experience her fuller being, which means anxious and fragile sides as well as bold and adventurous sides.
Vulnerability and also experiential challenges and risk-taking and the like.
Yes, with support, of course, but not... over-intrusion by the parent. Yes.
Again, our guest is Kirk Schneider. His book is The Polarized Mind, Why It's Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. And I'd like to invite those of you listening to join us and join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. You are welcome to put in your two cents. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us live by calling that number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Email address is forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Again, according to psychologist Kirk Schneider, corporate swindlers, stubborn ideologues, school gunmen all have one thing in common. He calls it the polarized mind. It's when someone believes that their point of view is right to the exclusion of all others. He says we see this with bullies and even addicts, bigots, and so forth, and that symptoms are hidden until, in many cases, something terrible happens. So join us in the conversation about the polarized mind. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Dr. Kirk Schneider, who is an adjunct faculty with Saybrook University and Teachers College at Columbia, and vice president of the Existential Humanistic Institute, also author of a new book, many books, but a new one called The Polarized Mind, Why It's Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. And we'll go to your calls here in just a moment. I want to go to some listener emails. Bill writes, just saw a movie about Hannah Arendt, known for the phrase banality of evil. She saw Eichmann as a person who did not think although he was not dumb. Do you think this is similar or different from your perspective?
It's a great question. My feeling about Eichmann, and this is based on limited study of his background and of her work on Eichmann, is that he, like others in Nazi Germany, grew up in a very constricted and demoralizing childhood context that in many ways sapped the life out of people. And there was not this encouragement, as I was talking about before, the parent delighting in the child. It was much more of a kind of, I think, mechanistic, routinized sort of upbringing, highly conformist, where a child wasn't encouraged to tap into imagination, to really explore fuller range of their feelings, thoughts, body, sensations, etc. And as a result, became extremely depleted and diminished. And I think that some of the behavior that Eichmann and others of his ilk engaged in was a way of, again, overcompensating for this terrible sense of smallness when they had the opportunity and the means to become, you could say, petty tyrants.
He said he was just following orders. That was all. He was part of a machinery.
That's what he said. That was a way to plug into a kind of godlike existence, it seems to me, and to do everything he could to avoid any hint of his fragility and vulnerability.
Matt writes, would you say the death of Trayvon Martin may feed into fears on the part of black people that the system doesn't defend or avenge them, that thus contributing to the fear of death you're talking about?
Please repeat that a little more slowly. And
would you say that the death of Trayvon Martin may feed into fears on the part of black people that the system does not defend or avenge them, thus contributing to the fear of death you are talking about?
Well, I think there's little question that this case is going to chill a lot of African Americans, as well as people of color, in regard to the sense of vulnerability, and for some darn good reasons, direct threat to life and limb. But it is also certainly not going to help on the symbolic side either, where even in the face of indirect threat, one may certainly now feel that much more fragile and impotent or helpless.
Well, this is what we're hearing from certainly a lot of members of the black community, especially parents of young black men. But let me bring our callers in. And Robert is our first caller. Robert, you're on. Welcome.
Hey, Dr. Snyder, very interesting. I look forward to reading more. And
Thank you.
It makes me think. Last night I was at San Francisco Juvenile Hall. I go a few times a month to visit the kids there and talk to them. And, I see that lack of wonder. The kids don't know how big the earth is or how old it is or how just amazing life is. And it really worries me. In my few minutes with them, I try to convey that a little bit. Who knows how much good it does.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. Thank you. You see that vacancy in the eyes of a lot of youth, unfortunately, and how to overcome it may be one of our great challenges as a culture. Let me bring another caller on here, and this is a caller joining us from up in Ashland, Oregon. Welcome.
Hi. I was wondering if the author has made any references to the attachment theory, where I've just finished a book by Siegel, and it's his second edition, and he has an excellent description of how the early infant, if it doesn't attach, and he has a very clear model for how that works, becomes either discordant or disorganized, and that there's a real pattern of pathology later in life, but there's no correlations, there's no longitudinal studies. And I wondered if the author was aware of attachment theory and what his comments were on it.
Oh, excellent question. Actually, I do address this in the book, in the latter part of the book. Yes, I see attachment theory as very relevant to this existential understanding. But I actually see attachment more in existential terms as, in some sense, helping the infant to find a ground within groundlessness. and the parent can help a child to feel that what we call ontological security, or security not only within the family system, but in being,
one's own being,
being itself, existence itself. And I think this is one of the great dimensions that existentialism brings to psychology, as it goes to these deeper kinds of relationships, not just with the family or the parents or even the culture, which are all integral, obviously, to our health and development, but to our primal relationship to being or existence itself. And the work of Shaver and Michelunzer actually is very important with attachment theory. And they've tied it to some of these deeper existential problems. Actually, their book, their edited book, which I'm a part of, came out through APA recently. I want to mention it because I think it's so important in terms of how professional psychology is moving more and more toward highlighting these dimensions I'm talking about. The book is called Meaning, Mortality, and Choice, The Social Psychology of Existential Concerns. And both Shaver and Michelunzer have chapters in there about how attachment theory raises questions of how we can come to terms more with our death anxiety. And it's integral, yes, to feeling like one can live more fully within one's own being, because there is that base of love and
I should mention
supply.
You're using gestures here with your stomach, like being full, like or maybe more your viscera than your stomach. Let me thank the caller and go right on to another call, and that's Neil. Good morning.
Yes. I'd be interested to know what you think of the physical disciplining of children. Is it always wrong, even if the child is way out of control? Children, like many adults, are not necessarily reasonable creatures.
Of course. And I realize this is a very controversial subject. The conventional perspective within psychology and based on psychological research is that it's really best not to use corporal punishment with children, that sets up all kinds of alarm systems that can exact a very heavy price in not only in the moment, but later on in their life, where kids could become, you know, basically emulate that kind of behavior themselves.
There's also that argument that my folks used to say, and they did use corporal punishment. My dad used a belt and everything. But they say, you know, a little SWAT, you know, to keep the kid from doing something that's self-injuring, or that can, you know, if they just do something over and over again, they get the idea that, I mean, not hard corporal punishment. I'm not saying that this is, I'm not advocating this. I'm talking about using my parents here in that old school example. Of bringing up children in a way that suggests that, you know, a little SWAT lets them know that they shouldn't hurt themselves.
Well, my feeling on this is that it's vital for the parent to, again, connect with this realization of how precious and how cherished this being, this child, is as a being and as one who comes from the vastness and the mystery.
You know, Kirkwood, I hear you describe it. I mean, it's eloquent and it's moving and maybe even inspiring. But I think about, like, a young woman who was so lost on crystal meth that she just left her kid, one-year-old kid, in a in a grocery store or something. I mean, it's a recent news stories like this all the time, abandoning children. I mean, it was a gas station bathroom in her case, but when you don't have that regard for children, when you don't even have that sense of there being anything other than something that's disposable.
I mean, see, this is why this whole issue is a systemic issue. You need to have parents who have come from such backgrounds themselves often, or who've had intervention that has helped them to connect with that sensibility about their own lives and the preciousness of life. And in order to do that, you need to bring more of a sense of awe to many settings, to child rearing, to the educational setting, to the work setting, because the parent's obviously bringing home great frustrations or demoralizations from the work setting.
Do you know what I'm intimating here? You may be preaching to the converted with this, as opposed to those who this can't even penetrate, or for whatever reason they are obtuse to.
Well, yeah, that's why these are very long-term projects, that we have to systemically change the culture. But in the shorter term, I call for something I call a Manhattan Project for Depth Psychology. I really think we need to mobilize.
You need to build a bomb?
Not a bomb.
But that's the Manhattan Project.
It's that kind of provocation, that basically we need to have depth psychological, intensive relational treatment for adolescents and youth in particular, nationwide, available at a very wide scale, so that kids who come from these very depraved or deprived circumstances have places they can go within the public mental health system that will substantively address their existential vacuum, their existential hole that they have in their lives, which is not dealt with, in my view, adequately enough by a few weeks of therapy or
maybe a few years of therapy even.
Treatment.
Sorry, here's a tweet. Can the author offer an antidote for polarized congressional leadership?
Well, I've written about this, and I've actually attempted to bring what I call experiential democracy to the legislative setting, and I've generally been rebuffed, although I had a wonderful public dialogue with Fiona Ma. She was bold enough to stand up with me in front of a group and discuss this idea, which is to basically bring a depth psychological facilitator to the legislative setting as a component of it, to have two legislators that are adversaries of one another to address themselves as real whole human beings, in addition to the issue, in addition to the political stance that they're taking.
Sometimes it's just seeing each other as real human beings. I mean, there's been the argument made on this program a number of times that people aren't in Washington as much as they used to be. They go to their home district. They're not really having social intercourse with one another if they're GOP or Democrats, and that is definitely a hindrance and maybe creating more of a polarized mind.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. There seems to be less and less caucusing, less and less time for person-to-person contact, and thereby a greater understanding in a whole body way of that other person, where they're coming from. And you could even apply things that we apply in, for example, couples counseling, like dyadic listening skills, where you have one party say their truth for 5 minutes, have the other listen as mindfully as possible, then reflect it back, and then reverse that, and then talk about, where are the meeting points here, if there are any? What is understood here? It seems to me the idea of sort of deep democracy, which I think Arnie Mandel has talked about, should be a vital component of the democratic process and of the diplomatic and political realms. Because it can lead to more thoughtful decision-making when it comes to issues of profound moral import. And right now, I don't think we have a great deal of thoughtful decision-making.
Well, we have a great number of callers who want to talk with you and listeners who want to weigh in here. Let me go to another call, and that's Ross in Sacramento. Good morning.
Good morning. My comment and question is, I was really concerned with polarized mind, but it sounds like it's polarized heart as well. It sounds like empathy and EQ, or emotional quotient, these are not in a large supply, especially in places like heads of corporations or heads of governments, where we see maybe a 4 or 5-fold increase in the type of psychopathology that most people would say is not good, a lessening of emotional attachment, emotional ability to empathize with others. I'm sure you're aware of the research that shows that there is a high degree of psychopathology in those roles as opposed to the general population. With
yes.
that said, and with this polarizing mind getting, or polarizing heart, I really want to stress the heart part. Do you think that politicians would be well served, like they release their IRS statements voluntarily, right? That no one forces them, but now it's mm-hmm. become, if you don't, you're looked at like, well, what do you have to hide? Why don't we start the I'll take a healthy brain scan or some kind of healthy test to show you that I'm a well-balanced person, because I'm going to wield a lot of power over everyone else. And mm-hmm. we can't force people to do this. Mm-hmm. But if we can make the social presumption that if you're a well-thinking, well-feeling person, you shouldn't have any problem taking this test.
Boy, I'd love to see that test, Ross. The kind of questions you could ask and assume that there's going to be veracity in the responses, particularly from politicians. Forgive my what may sound like cynicism. But
well,
response, Kirk Schneider?
Yeah, well, how about bringing more of the arts and humanities back to the educational curriculum? Would-be politicians are exposed to the kind of deep critical thinking skills that becoming more attuned to literature and the arts demands, and especially with very quality teachers.
Remember the playwright Edward Albee once said to me, "You should," in an interview we did on the air, "we should not only foster this at the earliest preschool level, but have students at that level constantly listen to symphonic music, be exposed to great art and so forth." And I think what we're saying, what you're saying is in gelled with that. Let me thank the caller. I want to get another caller on here, and that's you, Timothy. Hi.
Yes, Dr. Schneider. Michael did not mention the massacre at the University of Virginia, that Virginia Tech massacre, the Korean immigrant,
yes.
The use of firearm. As maybe your thesis in your book, The Polarized Mind, you were mentioning how to combat terrorism, its use for combating terrorism. But then you look at the firearm used by Koreans in the Rodney King riots. There's a dichotomy there, a kind of a polar opposite use of firearms. And then Michael raised Columbine, the massacre there. These were two students who came from the East Coast, from Jewish backgrounds. They seemed to be alienated. They were referring to their victims as whites. They're going to kill the whites, yet many Jews would consider them to be white. How does this polarize?
If you're talking about Columbine, there were two young assassins. One was half Jewish, and the other was not of Jewish background. So your data is wrong on that, simply wrong. And you can actually, I think, verify what I'm saying here quite easily.
Yeah, I don't think this is confined to one religion, per se.
I think that's indeed
this
the case.
Very spread out.
Houston writes, your guest and you commented on the importance of self-esteem, but I would argue that an emphasis on self-esteem instead of self-respect is actually part of the problem. Self-esteem just means you feel good. Self-respect means you hold yourself to a higher standard. One simply takes a feeling while the other takes an actual action.
Well, I guess I have problems with some of these studies that indicate that people who are sociopaths and narcissists have a lot of self-esteem. You know, I think part of the problem is that researchers sometimes,
just another correction in that last call. Those two young people were not from the East. They were from Colorado. They were born and bred, I believe, in Colorado. Maybe Klebold wasn't. But anyway, go on. I'm sorry.
I think sometimes researchers don't get down enough to the actual clinical setting and what we see with clients who have these kinds of disorders or extremes in their lives. And usually what we see is that they're very destroyed little boys and girls. They're very wounded. And if you can get them in a setting where you can deeply unpack this overlay of bravado or of so-called bold behavior.
Which you're saying is often
compensatory
behavior.
It's often very compensatory. It's reactive, yeah.
Let me read a few reactions to your thesis here. Listener writes, perhaps Mr. Schneider's premise is not only lacking hard scientific data, but is inherently flawed. Clearly, there have been many ideologues and singularly visionary, polarized thinkers who have made significant contributions to civilization. After all, our founding fathers were certainly polarized in their rejection of the British crown and in their decision to wage violent revolutionary war. Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. also believed their perspective to be right above all others. I don't consider myself ideologically opposed to psychologists like your guest, only semi-opposed to the facile pseudoscientific theories they conjure. I'd respectfully suggest Mr. Schneider's premise be examined skeptically.
Well, I appreciate your comment, but I refer you again to Shaver and Michelinzer's book, again, through the APA. It's chock full
American Psychological Association, yeah,
conventional research on this topic, and it's called Meaning, Mortality, and Choice. The other issue...
Some wouldn't call that hard evidence, though, social science or psychological data. I mean, it can be empirical and it can be, you know, through a lot of observation and collection of data, but can also be pretty soft.
Well, this data that I'm referring to comes from what we call hard experimental data, but my thesis is based on depth psychological research, which is often qualitative and descriptive, as well as that hard data. It's one of the few places, actually, where the two are very converged on this point of how the sense of helplessness and groundlessness and death anxiety drives so many of these behaviors. And I just want to take one exception to the caller about our founding fathers, Gandhi, and so on. You know, I draw a very sharp distinction in my book between polarization, which is based to a great extent on opposition and on doing everything one can to avoid the opposite of where one is at because it's so terrifying. In other words, it's fear-based and panic-based. And extremism, which is not necessarily polarizing. It only becomes polarizing if it becomes fixated and chronic and is basically based on terror and not so much on affirmation. Now, I would contend that our founding fathers in many ways were extreme, and so were many other revolutionaries throughout history, and extremes can sometimes be very powerful and very important in promoting the health and well-being of a society or a person, and is necessary for liberation.
But you could be polarizing your thinking of virtue or your thinking of goodness. I mean, that can be a polarized mind too, and would be, I presume. It's not always necessarily malignant if you think this is good and I can only see this as good and it meets, say, the common notion or utilitarian notion of what good might be.
I'm not sure it's polarized if it allows for some flexibility, something I call a fluid center, you know, where somebody may be emphasizing a certain passion and going after a certain goal, let's say, or aspiration, but it's without the dogma and the tyrannical quality that we see in polarization. So I see that as the difference. That it's not so much like with the founding fathers. It wasn't so much based on fear. It was also based on a vision and an affirmation, precisely because they weren't so panic-driven. However, there are very dark sides or shadow sides to that whole thing because obviously the American Indians did not benefit from much of our embarkation.
Here's a caller from New Hampshire, and let's get you on. Karen, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My just question had to do whether the author talks about in the book any correlations with the standard diagnosis that we tend to look at in mental illness, and particularly sort of circular thinking as well as, you know, paranoid thinking. And the other phenomenon is that many times people who may have this type of polarized thinking seem on some level to still be able to function in the world. In other words, they're not incompetent. So just any comment on that would be appreciated.
Yeah, I would say, thank you for the question. I would say that there's a very wide spectrum of polarizations, within the realm of, let's call it, dysfunctional behavior, where certainly some people can function okay, even though they are chronically stuck in certain ways or extreme in that polarized way I was explaining before. I think what I wanted to address was the earlier part of your question, which is whether this thesis is relevant to people who suffer what we call psychopathological polarizations. And yes, I do think so, because the basis of psychological suffering, again, this is my strong feeling, both in my own life, too. I have faced a lot of these and continue to face these kinds of demons, but had a very pivotal moments in my own childhood. The basis for a lot of these polarizations is some trauma that makes one fixated and over-identified with one point of view to the utter exclusion of competing points of view.
We'll have to leave it there. The book, again, is A Polarized Mind by Kirk Schneider. And thanks to the listener who corrected me. Patty McCormick was in the bad seat, not Patty McGuire. And thank you for listening and being a part of this morning's program. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.